Hello, everyone. We're back. We're the Blue Stairs Telehealth Radio Show, and we're a premier healthcare consulting company that provides skilled advisors, technicians, clinicians, and project leaders to support or help define and achieve your goals. Blue Stairs partners with you to find the solution you need to achieve the highest results. We are skilled in analysis, planning, support, and optimization, specializing in telehealth, interim leadership, business planning, and technical redesign. Our team averages over 25 years of healthcare experience and has serviced clients nationwide. Our experience matters. We make the investment by building a partnership with our clients, providing the highest quality resources and assuring positive outcomes. And as always, with us tonight is our show sponsor and guest host, Blue Stairs Managing Partner, Michelle Hager. Hi, Michelle. Welcome back to our Blue Stairs Telehealth Radio Show. Hey, we had a very busy week at the end of September up here in the Northeast. What'd you think?
Oh my gosh, we did. We had a crazy few weeks. Not only did we exhibit at the annual New England Telehealth Resource Center Conference in Southbridge, Massachusetts, but we also had the pleasure of spending some time with some very interesting and experienced clinicians and experts in the world of healthcare. And we were able to meet some clients and consultants along the way. So it was a great few weeks.
Yeah, it was. And some of these clients were on the radio show. We had Dr. Paul Heinzelman, SetMD, was on 2 weeks ago. And Dr. Christine Rooney from Lawrence General Hospital was on with us. And
Emmy Award winner.
She's an Emmy Award winner for Deep Blue and her husband. And more to come on that. Rick Boudreau from Maine General Hospital. It was good to see him up in Maine, but he's been on the show a few times. And Christine Pillsbury and Saffron Duffy from Monadnock Community Hospital up there in Peterborough, New Hampshire. It was great to see them, and we'll definitely have them on the show soon enough. So moving on to our first guest, and I'm really excited about this one, Nate Lackman, Chair of Telemedicine and Digital Health Industry Team at Foley & Lardner, board member at American Telemedicine Association. Nate is a healthcare regulatory and business lawyer who advises entrepreneurial healthcare providers and technology companies on business arrangements, compliance, and corporate matters in telemedicine, digital health, remote patient monitoring, and click and mortar offerings, working with hospitals, provider groups, and startups to build sustainable, scalable telemedicine arrangements across the United States and internationally.
Great to have you on the air, Nate. It's great to have you on our radio show today.
Well, thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Joe. It's really great to be here. I've been a fan of yours, Michelle, for a long time. And so it's really exciting to have a chance to, I don't know, officially record our conversations.
Feeling seasonal. Yeah, thank you.
You guys always have a good sidebar. So thank you for your time tonight. And it's great having you on the show. I think our listeners are going to get a lot from this. But let me just move on here. Last month on the show, we were joined by Dr. Joe Cavada, who is the incoming president of American Telemedicine Association, to help support and promote the second annual 2022 Telehealth Awareness Week that was celebrated this year on September 18th through the 24th. This ATA event was located in Boston this year and will present at a new venue every year in September. You can find all of the Telehealth Awareness Week events and information and presentations info on their website at telehealthawareness.org. So Nate, as a board member of ATA, what else is going on with ATA this year? Can you tell us about ATA Action and ATA Edge?
Sure, I'd be happy to. ATA Action was created about a year ago, and it's the ATA's affiliated trade organization. So it's a separate a corporate entity, and it is their sort of proactive response to actually allow for direct advocacy on the state and federal level. ATA is a nonprofit member association, is not allowed to engage in those type of activities beyond a certain threshold, like any sort of 501c3. And so this is a different entity that is allowed to have companies use it as the vehicle to enact legislative change and policy advocacy. It's been really pretty excellent. It's got a great response from the ATA members and the telemedicine industry. Because absent, I guess, one or two other examples, which largely focus on Medicare or licensing writ large, there's been no comprehensive advocacy government affairs organization that focuses on the state. And we know how telemedicine law and just many other things in the U.S. is like really controlled by the state by state. And so by having the single vehicle source we can create more homogeneity and consistency on state laws across various states, thereby allowing hospitals, AMCs, and telemedicine companies to build and scale their services quicker, better, and with more standardized quality. It's been pretty great. I think in the short term, their biggest impetus is to ensure that the temporary flexibilities put in place during the COVID public health emergency would last at least through the end of 2023, and trying to avoid what's known as the telehealth cliff. Right? So they try to work to make these policies permanent, and they're doing it through federal legislative advocacy and direct action, as well as on the state-by-state basis. And then finally, they've created some coalitions, in particular one for patient voices, because patients are the recipients of our healthcare services, but by and large, our industry doesn't talk about what the patient experience is or what patients want. We might talk about what doctors want or clinicians or hospitals, but the patients are almost like, yeah, they're going to get whatever we give them. And so I think it's a really great way of looking at healthcare by saying, what do the patients want? What do they care about? And how can we fold that into telehealth services?
Yeah, I think that it's really important what you're talking about, the ATA action in particular, and then, of course, the summit that I know you're going to talk about as well, which is the ATA Edge. But action as a member of the American Telemedicine Association, I think, is such a, what I've found is it's been such a great resource for me to also stay ahead and be aware of things that are changing or that things that we need to make comments on during public comment periods, for example. And the really important work, I think, that I've seen ATA Action do is create these collaborations of organizations. And you kind of alluded to that, of putting these collaborations together so that it's not just the American Telemedicine Association saying, hey, this is important. It's the AMA, it's the AHA, it's HIMSS, it's individual chapters of HIMSS, it's, you name it, all these other affiliated organizations that also have a stake in these laws that we really need to be taking a look at and determining if they're, if they're worth keeping as time goes on, and those that are important that will have, you know, big impacts on the way that care is provided. We need to really make sure that our legislators understand the consequences of changing that if they choose to do that, or as you said, keep temporary flexibilities in place permanently beyond 2023.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ATA historically has done and I've been a volunteer with them for almost a decade. I was elected to the board of directors this year, so I'm a freshman on the board.
Congratulations.
But I'll say, like, ATA has for years done really great work on policy and saying these are the what telehealth should be and could be, right? Yeah. But that's been limited to conferences and putting out thought leadership and publications. The board of ATA then created its own policy principles to help direct, and members can get involved. The ATA board has some really big household names of the members, you know, CVS, Meta, Ascension. We have health plans, Humana, United, there's Babylon, but then there's also like Salesforce and Bio IntelliSense. And so it's a good representative mix. Yeah. But ATA Action has a number of companies that are much smaller, right? They're high growth, earlier stage, who's care deeply. Like, sometimes their entire business model is predicated on getting some of these laws and rules changes made permanent. So they're highly activated and really interested. And it's not like a closed club. Like, people can join and contribute to ATA Action. So it's a way for maybe a smaller company or entrepreneurs or interested people to get involved on the direct action side and say, okay, this is the type of bill that Congress should be signing and considering, as opposed to these are the concepts that make for good legislative policy in telehealth. So it's a really great foil. And we've already seen significant success on a different state-by-state issues that pop up where ATA Action is able to get in there, boots on the ground, and make some change.
I agree.
Yeah, and then you had mentioned the conference. So the ATA Edge has a policy. It's called ATA Edge. It's their policy conference. It's every December in DC. It's the first weekend in December. And it collects about 300 people or so in mostly lawyers, policymakers, government affairs, personnel, politicians, and high-level government employees at agencies, as well as some entrepreneurs and CEOs. And so you get a bunch of these policy geeks all together in a room for about like 2 or 3 days, and they just talk shop. And it's really, really fun. It's like a safe place to kind of wonk out on telemedicine and digital health law. I love it. And I think everybody who attends it has a high repeat attendance rate, right? There's not a lot of attrition because they just see how valuable it is. And so if you're someone who's interested in that space, it's a great place to meet a lot of like-minded folks.
I love it too. I'm the policy wonk on the team. So they always are saying that to me, Michelle, you go to those public policy events versus everyone else. So I agree. It's a great event to learn a lot. And also, as you said, to share information and really start to stretch, you know, what would happen if, and what do people think about a variety of different topics. So it's great. Joe, I know you have a question.
No, I agree. It's important to keep ATA in our focus, and they're doing such a great job of including everybody in all the different healthcare fields. So more to come on ATA. I just wanted to get this interview started with Nate regarding telefraud and telemedicine fraud. And, what's the difference and what's going on right now?
Yeah. So in July of this year, HHS OIG published a special fraud alert about arrangements of telemedicine companies. And these special fraud alerts come out from time to time, and they're basically issued after the Department of Justice asks OIG repeatedly to give feedback on how they will testify in prosecutions. And when OIG sees these requests happen so many times, they say, all right, why don't we just put out something that says, here's our position, here's what you can expect us to say. And it serves as like an extra level of guidance to the industry at large. Right. So this is something lawyers should do or compliance officers should know about. But here we're noticing a trend of something that's problematic. It's happening very frequently. And so let's put out some guidance specifically on it. And that's what they did. And they put out 7 characteristics that they think could suggest any given arrangement poses a risk of fraud and abuse, which is largely, kickbacks or medically unnecessary services. Fundamentally, OIG does recognize and is aware that most practitioners appropriately use telehealth services during the PHE. They also distinguish between telefraud and legitimate use of technology to deliver healthcare services. So these telefraud type examples are really just a traditional kickback where maybe a DME supplier or a pharmacy is paying for everything. They're hiring a marketing company who in turn hires doctors. And then the doctors are given patients because they're cold calls or soliciting the leads. The doctors issue prescriptions, oftentimes without even consulting the patients, maybe listening to an audio recording of a conversation the patient had with a sales rep, or really not creating valid doctor-patient relationships by and large. And then those prescriptions are automatically routed back up to the pharmacy or the DME supplier who's paying for the entire thing, which violates patient freedom of choice laws, which say, hey, a patient should be able to choose whatever pharmacy or supplier they want the order prescription to go to. You know, you got your community pharmacy, you got a mail order, whatever, let the patient choose. And because it's set up as that closed universe type of architecture, you can see how the money just flows Medicare to the pharmacy, filtered down through a marketing company to a doctor, and then it goes all the way back up to the pharmacy who's paying for it. That type of setup is a high risk of kickback and medically unnecessary services. It can also exist in person. In fact, it has existed in person. It's simply the scalability of using telephone calls or whatnot to do it bigger, cheaper, faster. So the OIG does recognize that's not the same thing as telehealth fraud, which would be, for example, you are doing bona fide medical consults virtually with patients, but you're billing all your E&Ms at a level 5, no matter what, right? Now, that's not how it works in real life. Some patients take more time, some patients take less time. And some people query whether you can even fully do a level 5 during a virtual only experience. I'm not a doctor, I don't know. But if you see someone dropping claims, hundreds of them, all level 5s, that would be a red flag. Another red flag that OIG has sort of identified on telehealth fraud as opposed to telefraud would be the actual amount of time. So there are some clinicians that they found in their data mining that claimed to have done so many ENMs in a given day that when you total the amount of minutes required to do all of those ENMs, it would be like 30 hours, right? Now, I don't know a calendar, or maybe they have a special watch update, but I think there's only 24 hours in the day, last I checked. So that would be an example of more of like a telefraud. They're assuming that because it's a virtual setting that the government might not know. And that's not true. The data mining makes it really, really easy for the government to find out. So those are the two differences. We got the alert. There's seven different indicia, none of which are per se fraud by themselves or cumulatively. But anybody who's doing telemedicine contracts should really take a look at them because they do represent factors that may raise eyebrows, right? There can always be things to explain it, but those are some of the red flags that people should keep an eye out for.
Yep. The impossible day, as you described, with the 36 hours of time, you can't possibly do all of that in one 24-hour day. So is it fair to say that this idea of telefraud really shouldn't be called telefraud, that it just should be general healthcare fraud?
I think so. Now, for what it's worth, the Department of Justice, right, and this has been going on for the last 10, 20 years, increasingly the penalties and costs of going to trial are so extensive, and it could be really existential lights out, that providers, hospitals, whatnot, increasingly just enter into settlement agreements. So mm-hmm. on a lot of these enforcement actions, there is not as nearly as much case law as you would imagine. Instead, we have a culmination of just press releases issued by the Department of Justice, which tells the Department of the DOJ's position, right? And there's none of these defendants are issuing their own press releases. And so it creates this like impression, right? You have corpus of just press releases going on, that's really all the industry has to draw from, where some of these may have been more defensible. And it's certainly sexy to say $100 billion telemedicine fraud,
right?
Rather than say, oh, here's another one that it's $100 billion simply because it's such high volume. And in fact, that's why the OIG chose to change their vernacular to telefraud versus telehealth fraud, whereas some of the DOJ press releases, they haven't. So be it. But I think that there is an understanding among people who are educated in the industry that there's a difference. I do think there was an unfortunate knock-on effect with some legislators just saying, oh, my staffers tell me that there's billions of dollars in telemedicine fraud. Why should I sign this bill expanding Medicare coverage when it's really not telehealth whatsoever?
Right, exactly. And although the DOJ guidances have been kind of more and more pointed, as you kind of pointed out there, it does kind of send a little chill through your spine when you read some of them sometimes. But it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out, because I do think it has had a bit of a chilling effect on this idea of, CMS having more and more payment parity in some of these areas and expanding their services for coverage. But let's talk about a little bit about asynchronous telehealth. And this is, where patients might select a series of questions or answer a series of questions, potentially sort of triage them. Hey, does your ear hurt if you pull this way or that way? Or, do you have spots on your throat? Those kinds of questions that you're asking to a patient before they actually talk to a clinician, whether that be a nurse or a doctor, through a telehealth visit. What are your thoughts on the use of asynchronous telehealth in a wider context and utilizing AI and machine learning? So where it's not just using it in a triage space, but in even wider usages.
Yeah, I'm quite bullish on asynchronous telemedicine, and I think the market already has responded. I remember this is pre-COVID, so time is mushy for me, right? But mm-hmm. I remember speaking at a conference saying how DTC async is coming, and it's going to eat the lunch of the video only providers. And I argued that in many ways, it's better. A proper async DTC is better than this interactive audio phone, just a mere phone call. And man, I got some blowback on stage right there. But fast forward, and you know, I'm pretty happy with how the market shook out, right? People have realized by time shifting the doctor-patient interaction that you can save a ton of money, you can have a lot of time and convenience. And by building out the patient-facing and physician-facing user experiences in a proper way to digitize the essential elements of the doctor-patient relationship and interactions, you can have high-quality, high-efficiency medical services done via telemedicine async. The kicker is that the doctor would engage in acceptable async telemedicine as opposed to what is called internet prescribing. Internet prescribing is prohibited in about 40 states or so, and is often found in the pharmacy board rules as opposed to medical board. And it basically says you can't prescribe a medication based solely on a patient's responses to an online questionnaire. Now, so that's how it shakes out. Now, the real query to your point is, well, when is it a questionnaire versus something else? Because when these laws were put on the books, it was in the 90s, and it was literally a single static questionnaire. What's your name? What's your address? What drug do you want, including controls? Oh, and what's your credit card number? That was it. Okay. And I've taken screenshots. There's some of these still exist in overseas pharmacies illegally selling into the United States. I've taken screenshots and showed it to clients and at presentations and stuff. And it's a significant difference from the dynamic, intelligent online medical intake processes that we see now, which are driven on clinical decision trees and evidence-based medicine. They're simply turned into an electronic interface format. So the way to do it right is ask the same type of questions that the doctor would ask in person for that H&P, but then also include clinically relevant extrinsic medical information that helps validate the veracity of the patient's self-reported responses. So for example, you're doing a DTC async derm, you explain like what was going on, your health status, all that, and then you include high resolution photo of the mole or the rash that allows the doctor to take a look at that and fold in your medical history. Or if you're doing a hair loss thing, photos of the scalp and the crown. Or if it's maybe in some diabetes, you'll have you'll upload a copy of your recent lab reports for your blood work, right? Mm. Not saying, oh, I'm fine, or this is what I remember my A1C to be. No, let's have it like it needs to be clinically valid, relevant medical information. And, you know, we research this stuff across all 50 states and we update it throughout the year and monitor it. And I am not aware of any medical board that has taken action against a doctor for telemedicine prescribing who does async in this manner. The ones where doctors have gotten their called into question on their standards are when they're doing internet prescribing. And I think you can see that reflection on the board.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is what's next, right? I look at not all of it, but much of the DTC async as merely an interim step in the evolution towards full ML and AI. But it's not there. It's not ready yet. But why wouldn't it be eventually, right? And the way to get to full AI and for medical and be comfortable with it is going through the FDA device 510K clearance and registration. And the FDA has already granted medical device registration for a handful of SAMDs, software as a medical device, and that are AI. One example is diabetic retinopathy. And that really is cool because then you have the confidence that this tool, the software technology, has been reviewed by our government agency designed to protect patients for their health and safety, that it's reliable, that clinicians can use it, which really brings it way further to direct use of with providers than CDS, a clinical decision support. So a clinical decision support tool, it kind of does that, but then you still need to have the doctor get her eyes on it and incorporate it. So when we get to this AI ML space for medical care, I think we'll see a significant reduction in cost, increase in efficiencies. Why does that matter? Because there's a fundamental supply-demand imbalance between the number of people in the United States needing healthcare and the number of clinicians, whether you're talking about doctor all the way to the medical assistant. There just aren't enough of them. And what we've been doing in our country for the last like 5 to 10 is applying technology to try to make up that gap as much as possible.
Yeah, the numbers are staggering between, you know, the number of physicians that we need to have and what we're graduating, and not just physicians, nurses, as you said, all the way to MEs. And that even goes to EMTs and paramedics, anyone in the clinical space. And not only did they resign, but we're not graduating enough. So we have to do something. And it's an evolution. We'll have to see how it evolves over time, as we don't have house calls anymore. We now have, you know, go to the physician, or we have telehealth as more of a house call kind of approach. But it'll be interesting to see how medicine will evolve as a result, even of COVID and new innovative ways like these technologies. What about AI as a decision-making tool? So when I think about artificial intelligence, you know, most people think of it as like a predictor, you know, a way for us to be smarter, kind of the next gen clinical decision support tool. But when it starts to get to the stage where we start to see companies leaning towards taking the AI for it to make a decision about medical practice and what those steps should be with the patient, does that put it into a category where it should be a medical device?
You know, I think it could. Right. And it all ties back to reliability, right? There's some special, people call them loopholes. They're just really how it was structured, but for the use of wearables that can be considered a wellness device. So they don't need to go through the same rigor of FDA review. But then the problem is, if those wellness devices are essentially relied on by patient consumers as a proxy for a proper medical device, and then if provider groups or telemedicine companies are saying, yeah, use this wearable and then we'll do remote monitoring, I don't know if the data that the doctor is actually obtaining is sufficiently valid or standard to make those clinical decisions. So that's one of the concerns about kind of just doing a little loosey-goosey. The other is just, if you're pure black box AI, it's programmed by a human being, and there's just inherent biases in that, or shortcomings. And I'm not saying that it's prejudices. I am saying it's just inherent biases. And let me give a concrete example. There's a number of companies that are working on AI type software that uses the front facing camera of your phone, of your smartphone, to visualize, you know, your face and your neck. And they can determine your heart rate and your blood pressure and respiration just by looking at that stuff. The early version, there, none of them have yet been approved by the FDA, right? But right. The early versions of those also only worked on fair skin people. Why? Because maybe that was the cohort of people who worked at the companies. And so there's an inherent bias in there already. And I think that needs to be targeted and addressed. Someone who's doing a lot of really exciting work in this is my friend Rene Quashi. He's the VP of Digital Health at the Consumer Technology Association. And maybe he would be a good guest for you someday, Joe.
Yeah, I will. I'll write it down.
Him and the thought leaders of the companies that they're working with, they're big tech companies who have the capability to create this type of software. And they're really trying to think about, you know, sort of tabletop. What would this look like end game before we just start building it? Because it's very much the whole thing like, oh, they were so focused on if they could build it, they didn't think about whether they should build it. And right. Renee and his colleagues are really spending a lot of time putting out publications and ideas about, this is going to be built. We recognize it. So let's talk about how it should be built before we really just start jumping into the deep end of the pool.
Right, right. And you're right, Renee would be a great guest. He's definitely a leader in this telehealth space. And I think this, your comments around the biases in machine learning and AI, it's learning from itself. So it's almost continuing to, what's the word I'm thinking of? Just continuing to move the biases that might already have been inherent in the original coding. It just continues to perpetuate that over time. So lots of concern about that. I think there, we'll have to watch this space. the GAO released a report recently on the examination of the audio-only visits, where patients are only talking to their physicians via phone. And they're concerned a little bit about the effectiveness of these audio-only visits, as you mentioned earlier about, you know, are you really able to do, you know, a level five visit with an audio-only or whatever level? Is it a clinically appropriate visit? Were you able to actually, you know, conduct the necessary components in order to be able to conduct an effective visit with the patient just simply over the phone? And since many of the patients and providers have been doing audio only during COVID, and we know that this will continue through 2023, how is it going to affect the industry if we see audio only removed as an option for care?
So audio only was certain during the PHE, CMS did allow separate reimbursement of these audio only services, the CPT codes 99441 through 43. Right. And that was embraced by a bunch of practitioners and patients alike. In fact, the AMA for years, if not decades, has been advocating or lobbying to decouple, right, or unbundle these telephone calls and make them separately reimbursable services. Right now, they're considered covered services, but not separately reimbursable. So if a doctor does it, she can't charge the patient or the health plan a separate amount of money. Even during the PHE, it was not unanimous among the healthcare or telemedicine industry about whether or not these audio-only codes should continue post-PHE. Clinicians did have reservations about, is this suitable clinical information that we should make this part and parcel of a permanent Medicare, notwithstanding the fact that a lot of people can't have the bandwidth or access to smartphones. So very much was an idea, people were debating the idea, is good enough care something we want to introduce into the Medicare program? And that's really dicey because on one hand, it's like, well, this person living in a rural area without a audio video phone, they're not going to get any care. And the other side of it is, well, just because they live in a rural area, does that mean we as a government can say it's fine to get like substandard care or just good enough care? So they were a difficult issue. Ultimately, CMS, they have said we're going to discontinue that. It's not yet been finalized, but that's what they proposed. And so their proposal, and we'll find out the final rule in a month or so, is that 151 days after the PHE expires, these audio-only calls will go back to their pre-PHE bundled status. The reason they did that is they said two-way interactive audio-video is going to be the Medicare requirement for telehealth. That's what the Social Security Act requires. And they just said that the statute requires it to be so analogous to in-person care that the telehealth aspect is essentially a substitute for face-to-face. And because audio-only telephone is inherently a non-face-to-face service, that modality fails to meet the statutory standard. Now, it sounds probably like a lot of legalese to some of the people in the audience, but the TLDR is like, we don't know if it's good enough quality, A. B, the statute doesn't even allow for it. So if you providers and patients want us to create new codes ourselves for audio only, y'all need to give us a bunch of clinical data to show that it is just as safe and effective to support making this a permanent part of Medicare coverage.
Right. And what do you recommend? I say, in addition to that, I have a follow-on question to that, but the mental health services, all the behavioral health services, that there is some carve-outs, some exceptions to that, correct?
Yeah, so there's carve-outs for mental health service while the patient's at home, as well as consults attended to SUD, substance use disorder care, when they're at home. Because like those are also just clinically very different services. It's just talking and consulting, right? But if you just said, okay, audio-only phone for E&M, that could be used in a mental health case, or it could be used in like a cardiac case or some abdominal pain. And because the clinical use cases are so varied for those type of E&Ms, they're not, the CMS is not yet comfortable.
Right. I just wanted our listeners to be aware that if they are in fact doing behavioral health services via audio only now, that is still going to be allowed. But you mentioned this idea of healthcare providers need to demonstrate the effectiveness of telehealth, that, you know, the CMS and HHS and OIG are all looking at, you know, this data. So what do you recommend that healthcare providers, if they're listening to this, this this radio show, what do you recommend that they do to effectively demonstrate how their programs are improving the care of their patients or providing sufficient or equitable care to their patients?
Yeah, I mean, something that I do, and I know you do, is that every time CMS puts out a proposed or final rule on telehealth coverage, we read it and read the, not just the rule, but the commentary, where CMS explains like their thoughts process and how they respond to public comments. And that really, that's a, like in poker parlance, that's a major tell, right? Yeah. And there are some repeated statements CMS makes almost every year. And it's this, it's, we've got an X number of comments requesting us to add some particular clinical service as covered via telehealth, or we've got X number of comments asking us to relax our in-person requirements. We're not opposed, and then the CMS will say, we're not opposed to doing that, but in order for us to have the justification, we need clinical evidence that it's not unsafe, and that it would be the similar approximation or equivalent of the type of in-person care. In many years, nobody submits that. They just ask their lawyers or lobbyists or just do it themselves, saying, ah, CMS, I want you to make the change. But they don't actually, it's like basically submitting a math answer without doing your showing your work, right? Mm-hmm. So what we really need are these interested providers to take the time to put the data together. And I know people do this in their clinical publications at JAMA, New England Journal and whatnot, but they have yet to do that in a comprehensive manner submitted to CMS, not just the legal policy rationale, because that's very strong. CMS understands it and they believe it. What we need now is the doctors and nurses and clinicians to step up and collectively take that data and submit it in an advocacy manner.
Yeah.
Until that happens, they're not, the change will be more incremental, or the CMS just won't be comfortable making that change.
Yeah, absolutely. And any of healthcare providers out there, please, please submit data. There are plenty of organizations that are working on these databases to try to help and connect up with them, including reaching out to the ATA. It's so important for us to be able to share this information and demonstrate the effectiveness of telehealth. Everything that we know is true is going to be borne out in the data, but if we don't have that data, we'll just be, you know, continuing to walk in place. And you mentioned the PHE and how that's going to affect folks, you know, and providers along the way. So the PHE extension, you know, we know that will be extended in January because we haven't received notification. We'll have the 151 days post, you know, the end of the PHE. Is the PHE end, is that going to, is the telehealth, you know, improvements that we've seen, that is that going to launch us into the future of healthcare? Or will, when the PHE is over, we're going to just go reverting back to what we saw and did 4 years ago?
Oh, I certainly hope not. Yeah, but even four, even 4 years ago, you know, our practice was going gangbusters, right? The PHE didn't make telehealth. It really just accelerated what was already occurring. So it made it occur much faster. And the reason it feels even faster than that was because it, at the same time of the PHE, there was a significant uptick in the capital markets, which made more money into venture capital. And they said, okay, we're going to turn our lens away from like other e-commerce stuff and like mattresses and shoes into health technology, right? And so a bunch of new startups were given birth at a faster clip than usual. That's not going to just disappear, right? So we may see a slowing down as like we return to an environment where people are in person more, but that's already the vernacular direction has changed from saying not everything is going to be virtual only. It's going to be click and mortar. It'll be a combo of virtual first or whatever you want to call it with the in-person as needed. And that makes a lot more sense because it right-sizes services. A bunch of stuff can be done virtual only, but a bunch can't. So I'll give you two predictions and we'll see what happens.
Come all right, we're writing them down. Yeah. Go ahead.
The first is I predict the PHE will expire in January of 2023. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be the date. And the second is that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and Tom Brady are going to win the Super Bowl.
Oh, you're a big Tom Brady fan now, I see, huh? Down in Florida. That's great.
Our listeners in,
our listeners in Boston will love that. Oh, boy. You guys are great. Great content, great expertise. Michelle and Nate, thank you so much for your time tonight. You know, our show's priority and number one goal is to provide our listeners with experienced healthcare experts and present the latest information in healthcare, not only locally, but on a regional and a national level. So thanks for coming on the show with us, Nate.
Joe, it was a blast. Thank you for having me. Have a good night.
This is Blue Cirrus Telehealth Radio on WATD Radio 95.9 FM.